We have more than a dozen wildfires burning across Washington and record heat on the way, and state officials are asking all of us to do our part and try not to start any new fires. Here's Car Radio's Hannah Scott.
This is an unprecedented and heartbreaking event.
Governor Inslee on the devastating wildfires in Washington state that have been fueled by gusty winds and dry, hot weather that's only expected to get worse.
An estimated 330,000 acres of our state burned just in 24 hours. More acres burned yesterday than in 12 of the last entire fire seasons in the state of Washington.
The fire is forcing hundreds to flee from their homes as fire crews short on resources struggle to fight back flames in every corner of Washington.
We know that we've been well prepared for fires. We fought them before. We know how to do it. But these conditions were unprecedented. They led to explosive growth of these fires as a result of the hot and windy and very, very low humidity conditions that were so extraordinary yesterday in the state of Washington.
The governor will be visiting some of the areas hit hardest over the next couple of days, starting with a visit to Graham today, where a half dozen homes were destroyed. Also in Pierce County, fire continued to spread in the Sumner-Bonnie Lake area yesterday, forcing even more evacuations in neighborhoods not typically hit with this type of fire activity. Tomorrow, Inslee heads to the east side of the Cascades, to the town of Malden, just south of Spokane.
Perhaps 80% of that has been burned out and totally destroyed. I just talked to the mayor and city council, who told me that it looked like a bomb had gone off. They lost their post office, their fire station, their city hall, their library, and most of their homes.
State Lands Commissioner Hillary Fran.
Currently, the largest fire is the Pearl Hill Cold Spring Fire near Omak, which has burned 280,000 acres and is 60 miles in length. Much of the state is under extreme fire danger, both east and west. These fires are a reminder that the wildfires is not an east or west issue. It is an entire Washington state issue. Yesterday, we had 58 starts alone in our state, and thanks to the hard work of our firefighters, local, state, and federal agencies, we were able to put most of them out. But we have 9 significant fires currently burning in eastern Washington, and these fires we are dealing with started fast and furiously early yesterday morning, breaking out up and down eastern Washington.
And with hot, dry conditions expected to worsen today and tomorrow,
we are urging every single citizen and resident of Washington State to do their part, as the governor mentioned, and prevent any starts of fires. It will help the men and women who are putting their lives on the line, in the air and on the ground, as well as our community members whose homes are very much in jeopardy and at risk.
The governor vowing to do all he can to help those who've lost so much already in these fires. Inslee also stressing that what we're seeing here now will only get worse in the years to come, and says to avoid similar devastation, we must act now.
If we're going to reduce homes from burning in 2025, we've got to start in 2020. In 2021, because by 2025 it's too late. When this wind is blowing and all of the grass is so dry because of climate change and so hot, and this wind gets going at 60 miles an hour, there's no force on earth that can contain that fire. At that point, it's just too late. So the work we need to do for these families in these communities, we need to start now to save them for the years and the decades in the future. And I hope people keep in mind the devastation we're suffering right now as we consider what we can do to prevent these fires.
So wildfires, high winds, especially bad combination in Whitman County, south of Spokane. Fire destroyed much of the old railroad town of Malden, as you've heard, as well as an iconic bridge near Colfax. And our resident historian Felix Bunnell takes a look back now at some of the history that was consumed in those fires yesterday, brought to you by the King County Library System. Hi, Felix.
Morning, Dave. Boy, I admit it. If I had ever heard of Malden before, I certainly didn't remember, so I decided to look into the history of it. It was founded around 1908. It was a division point for the railroad known as the Milwaukee Road. This was the last of the big railroads to build a transcontinental route across Washington and the Cascades. Now, Malden was actually on the main line between Puget Sound and Chicago. They built a big rail yard there and a roundhouse, which meant jobs and a reason to be for the town. I talked with a historian working on his PhD at the University of Montana, who focused on Malden for his master's degree when he was at Eastern in Cheney. Bob Lambeth told me that Malden really boomed and had as many as 1,000 residents around 1920 in a robust commercial district. But that was over within about a decade or so when the railroad shifted operations elsewhere. When he was studying the town and visiting it a lot 6 or 7 years ago, Bob Lambeth developed a sort of melancholy affection for Malden and how and why it had changed.
I could only find a picture of one of the hotels. They had the Empire Hotel there, and then they also had the Malden Hotel. And if you see some panoramas of the town, there was quite a bit of several dozen structures aside from private residences. There was a lot of businesses there. So it's just kind of a very, you know, eerie feeling when you look at these old images and you kind of realize how much of a community this place was several decades ago, that even up until 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, how much it had just really suffered as a result of the kind of larger socioeconomic downturn of rural America.
And so Bob said it was heartbreaking to hear the news about Malden yesterday. And from what he told me, it sounds like it was kind of a bittersweet place. Had some of those same serious issues with drugs and crime in the recent past that so many rural communities have struggled with in not only this area, but all over the West. I also spoke with Valerie Gregory. She's the executive director of the Whitman County Historical Society in nearby Colfax. She's also director of the Colfax Chamber of Commerce. As of Tuesday afternoon, she said it was still too soon to say what comes next for Malden.
They're still evacuated, so I noticed that the Whitman County Sheriff's Department asked that nobody go into Malden right now because it still is an evacuation zone, and so they're not even letting the people that homes are saved, which there's not very many, or the people at like the post office and stuff. None of them have been able to even go back into the town because they have it kind of just blocked off right now, because they're still trying to get out some hot spots and make sure that nothing sparks back up.
Yeah, that post office, that has been the post office since 1913. It was originally built as a bank, but it's been operated continuously for 107 years?
Yeah.
Now, Colfax is about 30 miles south of Malden, so it was a separate fire just north of Colfax that destroyed one of Washington's only remaining covered bridges.
It was one of the most photographed structures in our area. You know, we have thousands of photographers come from all over the country just to photograph our area because of our rolling hills. And the Manning Bridge was iconic because it went over the river. It was actually built because it was for the railroad, and it was in 1918, it was for electric railroad. And that's why the top of the bridge was open. It was considered a covered bridge, but only the sides were covered. And the top was open so that the electrical wires could go over the top.
And the photos Valerie shared, which we'll have at My Northwest, are just heartbreaking. It was a cool old bridge over the Palouse River, left over from a rail line that connected Spokane and Pullman. It's been privately owned by a nearby homeowner for about 50 years. They converted it from a railroad bridge to an automobile bridge. Now, Michael Hauser is a state architectural historian. He told me the point of covering a wooden bridge is to protect the wood from the elements so it lasts longer. I had never thought about that before. Yeah. I thought that they looked cool. he also told me the open-top design of the Manning Bridge made it pretty rare.
Well, it was the only one that I know of in the state that had that kind of a system to it where those side trusses are boxed in. So I would say it's, you know, fairly unusual in Washington State. And I don't think I know of any others actually in the Pacific Northwest that have that design.
So it's a real loss. I also reached out to Chris Moore. He's executive director of the Washington Trust for Historic Preservation. And he told me people love covered bridges. Like other big pieces of infrastructure, they have an almost tactile quality.
You can walk up to a covered bridge and touch it or walk across it if they're open to the public. And those types of places tie you to the history that they represent. With the place actually gone, the physical structure actually gone, yeah, we have images, we have the history books, but that's not the same as being able to go to a spot as a way to evoke the history and its associations.
And it was on the National Register of Historic Places and had been for the last almost 40 years. So Valerie Gregory says, as far as she knows, there weren't any casualties in Malden. She said photos have been spreading far and wide in the aftermath, and one image in particular has really captured people's attention.
I think the best photo that they got, though, was the whole town of Malden almost burned, and the only thing that was still standing was the American flag, and it didn't burn. That at least brought a little bit of hope, I think, for people that, like, okay, we're still here. We all have to stick together.
Yeah. So it's just an incredible amount of history lost just in mere moments. And the pictures from Malden in particular, where the fire just ravaged what had been this little tiny sort of rural, almost like a ghost town. I mean, lots of people lived there. But the commercial part of the town had been gone for so long, the bulk of it. It just is this incredible contrast now between what was there a few days ago and what's there now. And the same thing for this beautiful old bridge.
It takes a piece out of you. I mean, this is not remotely similar, but I mean, the summer cabin that we'd owned up in the Adirondacks for many, many years. I used to spend summers there as a kid. My parents had sold it long ago, but we got news that it had burned down over the winter. And you see pictures of that with just the chimney remaining, and it feels like a piece of you is gone. And when it's a place that you've lived in your whole life, especially your own home, that's tough to deal with.
Yeah, and most of the people in this area around Manning, Malden, are multi-generational, been there for decades and decades and decades. So it's a real loss.
Thank you, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
Pinnell, brought to you by the King County Library System. All of his features are at mynorthwest.com. Let's talk about Boeing, which has revealed another manufacturing flaw in the 787. This time it's not in South Carolina. This time it's at a production plant in Salt Lake City, and Chris has been following that.
Yeah, Boeing says the problem is with the horizontal stabilizer on the tail of the 787. It says pieces of the stabilizer were clamped together too tightly, which can cause gaps in the airframe that are larger than acceptable. Boeing says this can lead to premature aging of the horizontal tail section, but doesn't pose an immediate threat. And this problem extends potentially to 893 Dreamliners, nearly all that have been built. Just under 1,000 of the planes have been produced. Boeing is correcting the problem for 87s that have not yet been delivered, and it's deciding right now if it's necessary for the entire fleet. But if it is, you can imagine what kind of undertaking that is going to be. This revelation, as you know, comes on the heels of the two other manufacturing problems, both found in the manufacturing processes in South Carolina. The inner skin of some planes were found to be too rough, and gaps were found where pieces of the aft fuselage are joined together. Well, the Wall Street Journal reported earlier this week that the FAA is now performing a broad review on the manufacturing processes at the plant in South Carolina that could include mandatory enhanced or accelerating inspections of hundreds of jets. The gaps in the aft fuselage section are filled with shims. We talked about that before, produced by computer. Wall Street Journal says the FAA has found that Boeing didn't test how it produces those shims or the material that fills the gaps to make sure they meet requirements. It also found a lack of a quality check to make sure that they did. And in fact, the Wall Street Journal went on to report that Boeing discovered the issue in 2019 and then reactivated a computerized quality check that for some reason had been turned off. And this potentially goes back to 2011 when production in South Carolina began.
So are we talking again about a culture problem here, which I know that over the years, longtime Boeing employees have complained about?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, you don't expect Boeing to stand up a plant like this and then not have the quality controls that it would accept here in Puget Sound. But from what we've heard anecdotally for the 10 years that South Carolina has been open, of all the rework that needs to be done from things that come in from South Carolina, I'm not sure if it's a problem of the workforce there or a problem of the manufacturing or the oversight or the lack of the inspectors that Boeing has been getting rid of over this similar time frame. I don't know. It's hard to pinpoint that, but you look at these problems. The FAA is now looking back for the entire lifetime of that plant. It starts to really point and maybe validate some of those things we've heard anecdotally from all of the people that we know that work at Boeing.
Now, should I read some significance into the fact that these production problems are surfacing just as Boeing has announced its possible plans to cut back production here?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, they found some of these things in 2019. They found some of these in 2020. I know the company would probably say it's coincidental, but I mean, certainly. And Boeing, let's face it, I don't think they're right now. I don't think they're playing favorites on South Carolina or Everett, because it's bleeding so much money. It has got to do the right thing for the company to keep it afloat, right? Whatever that means. But this certainly doesn't help South Carolina's case if they've had endemic problems for their entire lifespan. I mean, do you want the work done fast or do you want the work done right? And so that's going to be a very interesting discussion as we go forward. But yeah, it is rather coincidental that all these issues out of South Carolina are coming up now. Maybe we'd have some more whistleblowers, from our side of the country, bringing things up and talking about things that they maybe wouldn't have in the past.
Yeah. This is Seattle's Morning News. There is a race for Secretary of State this year between incumbent Republican Kim Wyman and Democratic challenger State Representative Gail Tarleton of the 36th Legislative District. And Gail is with us today. So why did you decide to run? Because isn't the Secretary of State kind of a, you know, one of the sleepier positions in state government? Why were you attracted to that after rising so high in the Democratic ranks in the legislature?
Well, thanks for having me, Dave. We have had a game-changing scenario since 2016, and I'm running because our voting rights are under attack. I'm running because our elections have been under attack since 2016. And then here we are in 2020, and now Trump is attacking our elections. So, you know, as a former senior defense intelligence analyst, I take seriously when you have both attacks happening, one from the outside, one from the inside. You better take it seriously. Don't ever take it for granted that we'll always have our democracy here.
Hmm. Well, I'm always reminded about that line from The Wizard of Oz with the good witch Glinda says, "Oh, be gone. You have no power here. Trump has no power here. We run our own elections, don't we?"
You know, Trump found the way to have power when everyone least expected it. He started dismantling the operational capability of the U.S. Postal Service.
Uh-huh.
And that's when we should have started paying attention. When we found out that mail sorting machines were being removed, that mail processing centers in Washington state were being removed, that collection boxes from the postal office were being removed. And most importantly, when we found out that postal workers' schedules were being massively disrupted so that they were not being allowed to deliver the mail on time. That's the warning sign. That's the shot across the bow. And then the final warning was when our Secretary of State got a letter July 31st from the post office saying, "Oh, by the way, don't count on your mails to deliver your ballots." And what was her response? Invite Trump to come tour our voting by mail. That's not a plan, and that is not a response that addresses the nature of the threat.
So
that's not a plan.
You don't buy this idea that the post office was just carrying out a previously planned efficiency program.
An efficiency program does not ordinarily include a removal of equipment that processes mail at high speed. Our mails are already disrupted, Dave. You know, I mail 5 letters a week from the post office in this state because all of my family and my husband's family lives on the East Coast. And it used to be 3 to 5 days I could count on them getting there. Now it's 7 to 10 days in Massachusetts or in New Jersey or in Virginia. There is no predictability, and that's the risk. No predictability.
But I've not heard anybody say, Washington State, you know, be very afraid that your ballot's not going to get there. I mean, do you have any indications that there's going to be a problem mailing out the ballots?
Dave, I don't know if you missed this, but the Attorney General Ferguson did file a lawsuit in our federal courts against the Trump administration. And his lawsuit was specifically focused on Washington State. Tell us where there have been damages done to the operational capability of the post office. And the first hearings were with the federal court in Eastern Washington, I think a couple of weeks ago. The last 2 weeks of August were, you know, sort of a blur for all of us. But what that judge said is, I need in my hands where the mail sorting machines have been removed, where the mail processing centers have been closed, what collection boxes have been removed, which counties have been most affected. And the Trump administration's response is, there isn't really any way we can provide you that information in a rapid period of time. Why would they say that when the Postmaster General says, well, I'm rescinding the order until after the elections?
Yeah. Okay. So what would you be doing then as Secretary of State that's not being done now by the incumbent?
Well, it's not right in Washington State that more than 1 million voters have been purged from the voter rolls during her tenure of 7.5 years. So I'd like to take a look at why that has happened. More than 750,000 of those 1 million voters have been put in a category of other. I want to make sure that there is no category of other, that our voter rolls should be very clear about why people are losing their right to vote in this state. And of course, there are obvious categories where people move, people are deceased, they have had some other situation which has caused them to lose their right to vote. But the category of other is 750,000 of the about 1 million people. That's not okay. The other thing I'd like to do is focus on why we have more than 1 million eligible age voters in Washington State that aren't even registered to vote. That's not okay that now a million other people who are eligible to vote are not even registered to vote. So I'll focus on voter registration, voter education, especially among the, you know, 100,000 or so people who have moved into this state. About 80% of them are of eligible age. They may not all be citizens, but we need to look at how many people are moving into this state every single year who don't have any idea what system of voting we have. And the third thing I'd like to do, you know, Dave, it's going to take a lot to recover from the damages done to our democracy, the attacks on voting by mail, the attacks on the Postal Service, the attacks on public servants, the attacks on veterans that have come out of the mouth of our president. You know, it's not partisan to stand up to someone who is attacking our democracy. It is not partisan. It is about protecting the rights of every person in this state. And, you know, when our right to vote is at risk, every right we have is at risk.
So what else could you do to encourage people to register? How would you make it easier? Because you can do it at the driver's license, right? You can do it at the libraries now. What else would you do?
Yeah, the legislature passed a lot of laws in 2018 after 4 years of trying. During my tenure there, we passed same-day voter registration. We passed free postage. We passed online voter registration, automatic voter registration. The incumbent Secretary of State opposed same-day voter registration. She opposed free postage. She opposed pre-registration of 16-year-olds. That has not been a priority of this Secretary of State.
I know that one of the things that she has brought up is that she thinks this office ought to be nonpartisan. Do you believe that, too, or should this continue to be a partisan office?
Anyone who runs for this office can declare a no party preference. She's run for this office in 2012, 2016 and 2020, and she has put a Republican Party designation by her name every single time.
Mm-hmm.
If she wanted it to be nonpartisan, I've sat in that legislature for the past 7.5 years in the same way that she has sat in that office. She never introduced a piece of legislation to make the office nonpartisan. If she wanted to, why didn't she? In this time that we are in, I run as a Democrat because I believe in the values that the democracy needs right now, which is to expand voting rights and to expand voting access and to protect our elections, to protect every vote. So I will leave it up to the voters to decide which vision for this office that they want to support.
Democrat Gail Tarleton, representing the 36th District, who is challenging Republican Kim Wyman for the office of Secretary of State. Gail, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Dave.
It's time for your Daily Dose of Kindness. I'm Miley Cady. Your Daily Dose is brought to you by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. Residents of senior living facilities are turning to internet radio to connect during lockdown.
Radio Recliner.
Pirate radio run by retirees.
Radio Recliner allows senior DJs to share music, memories, and even send messages to loved ones. Chip Reed with CBS This Morning has that story.
For residents at senior living communities across the country.
Now my DJ name, Boomski.
A new internet radio station is helping people tune in and stay connected.
Hello, Radio Recliner listeners. We are kind of, you know, socially tied down right now because of a thing called a virus.
Lee Flynn has been on lockdown for months at his facility outside Atlanta.
There's a lot of people here, but I walk down the hallway and it's like a haunted house.
Now Flynn and other seniors can create their own playlists and record hour-long shows for an online audience without even leaving their rooms. Hattie Miles is known at her community in Alabama for her collection of hats.
You've got your own show. How does that make you feel?
Empowered.
You feel empowered.
Yes, I feel that I have something to offer.
It's sort of become a social media for seniors.
Mitch Bennett launched the program at Bridge Senior Living Facilities in 14 states, but has now had requests from around the nation.
There's something about old-time dedication radio that really resonates with these residents, and music has so much meaning and kind of creates these vivid memories.
Down there's a town we did roam.
Ed Rosenblatt, known as DJ Windjammer, plays the ukulele on his show and the piano for his community every evening.
We can't have more than 10 people in a place at one time, but if someone's passing through the area, they'll stop and they enjoy the music. And it makes me feel good
And that's how you feel about Radio Recliner too.
It's an outlet. Absolutely. It's an outlet for the DJs who are doing it. And it's, again, it's something else. It's an outlet for people who are listening.
Is radio stardom in your future?
You know, anything is possible. I'm waiting for my phone to ring, and I'm available.
For CBS This Morning, Chip Reed, Washington.
If you'd like to tune in, you can go to RadioRecliner.com.
Miley Katie, the magic of radio. And now, from the Gian Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon, right here on Cairo FM, here is G. Scott. NFL season starts tomorrow. I don't feel ready somehow. I haven't seen any preseason games or anything else, but it starts tomorrow. And I understand that there's some good news here, that the NFL has become the model for COVID prevention.
Yeah, I remember talking about this on your show and how important it is for pro sports to come back and successfully do well under these conditions. We saw what happened with the NBA and NHL being inside of a bubble, but outside of a bubble, the NFL has done a great job. As a matter of fact, the NFL administered, Dave, 44,510 player tests over the past week. They had one positive result.
That's great.
You know,
So what's been the secret? Because they do so much testing, so they know exactly who has it and they can isolate them, or what?
Daily testing.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, daily testing. This is something I was talking to my son and his roommate about when I was out there in Columbus. And they both admitted, some of the things my son admitted to me. He was like, "Yeah, Dad, I didn't do a good job of really taking it that serious." But once he got out to Columbus and he was being tested twice a week, you start to take it a little bit serious. Like it's almost like when you get ready to jump on a scale, right?
Yeah,
right? One of the things I don't do, Dave, I don't jump on a scale on Monday morning because I already know. You know what I mean? But when I have been doing a good job and I know that I have to get on that scale, or whether you wait, maybe your Weight Watchers or something like that, when you know you have to get that test, well, you like to be better prepared. And so I think that is the reason for the success.
Wow. Okay, so Chiefs versus Texas. Chiefs won the Super Bowl, and nobody in the stands. Did I ask you already about whether the Seahawks have to worry about the absence of crowd noise?
I don't know that you did, but I'm going to say, hey, it's no secret that home field advantage in the 12s there at CenturyLink has been an advantage over the years. We talked about it. Players talk about it. Coaches talk about it. It has been an advantage. We're not going to have that right now. And is that a little bit of concern? Maybe. I don't know how much it's going to play into it, but I do know that when you're at CenturyLink Field, when the Seahawks are out there, man, that is a huge advantage having that. And so that's going to be a little bit weird not being at the game. But as far as our fan experience, Dave, I think our fan experience is going to be pretty cool because we're going to get to see more, I believe, more behind the scenes and more of the reactions of the sidelines since we're not seeing the fans.
Right. DeAndre Hopkins has become the highest paid non-quarterback. He's with Arizona. What position is he?
He's a wide receiver.
Wide receivers typically, how much money does he make it?
Oh, he just got himself close to a $100 million deal, but more importantly, he is up there making like $23, $24 million a year. He's making big money, and he did the deal himself.
Yes.
That is the biggest headline of it all.
What does that negotiation go like? I mean, you're a pretty good negotiator from what I hear, anyway.
Yeah, I'm a good negotiator.
So what do? You go into a deal like that, and you say, okay, I know I'm not a quarterback, but what does he say next?
Well, he goes into it, and he has a consultant, first of all. He doesn't do everything by himself, but he has a consultant to help him out. But his biggest argument, he goes in and he says, okay, I'm a receiver. Receiver's top money. The last receiver to get paid good money was Michael Thomas from the Saints. So the Saints wide receiver, he set the market, and he has a $100 million deal. And so he makes this. So what usually happens, Dave, is it's always next person up. So in this case, DeAndre Hopkins goes in with his consultant and says, okay, I'm a receiver. Here's my numbers. I'm a starter. I'm one of the top receivers in the game. Here's where I compare. And so then the Arizona Cardinals have a choice by saying, okay, we got to try to not pay you as much as you want. Let's meet in the middle, and we just go from there. So the biggest thing is he goes off of his market.
Yeah, but what's his hammer? Receiver. So he says, give me this or else what? So what would he be able to tell them there? I don't know how it works. So good. Does he have the flexibility to say, give me this or I walk?
He has the flexibility of saying, hey, I would like to get a deal done right now. So then, therefore, when I'm kind of up here pretty soon, I won't go ahead and take a deal elsewhere and leave. So, yeah, that's where it kind of gets down to leverage. And then some teams, they have that choice, right? They can either sign you. And then we've seen it in the past where we've seen players say, hey, you know what? If you don't sign me right now, you don't give me this money, I'm not going to show up to training camp.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's kind of working tough for the players. Yeah. For some reason, these NFL teams are pretty good at holding out when they do that.
G. Scott, G. and Ursula, 9 o'clock. Thank you, G.
Thanks, guys.
Since 2012, following a series of incidents caught on video, the Seattle Police Department has been under the watchful eye of the Department of Justice. And now, the person overseeing what's known as the consent decree has been replaced. Kite Radio's Hannah Scott has the story.
Merrick Bobb had been the federal monitor overseeing the consent decree since 2013, but yesterday, the federal judge overseeing those reforms named a new monitor. Bobb tells me he resigned his last day, August 31st, and that it was simply time to move over and let a new team take over after nearly 8 years that saw him nearly lead the city of Seattle and SPD through the final chapter of the consent decree, a 2-year sustainment period of full and effective compliance.
At that point, that's pretty much what my goal had been in all this, to not get all the way out. And there were some events that, that intervened, including the recent protests and demonstrations. And so I think it'll be part of the job of the next monitor to help get them back to the point that they were when they were in full and effective compliance.
Of his time as monitor, Bob says,
there is no question but the city has made tremendous progress under this consent decree. It is in a far different place than it was 7.5 years ago, right in the wake of the shooting of the wood carver.
But he says recent events, including the SPD response to protests over the death of George Floyd, have proved a significant setback for the city.
What happened was very unfortunate, and I think it had a lot of people very concerned and disturbed that perhaps the SPD really had forgotten the lessons of the consent decree. It didn't happen entirely during their conduct during the protest. So I happen to believe that the department is capable of getting back into compliance. It may take a while.
And he says Seattle will need to make significant changes in policing.
Have a real and a reformed disciplinary and accountability system, which they don't have at this point.
Bob says that will have to involve a hard look at collective bargaining and the police union, among other things.
There are lots of players, and it's quite complex.
In a letter obtained by the Seattle Times, Bob also said SPD was in desperate need of a new police chief from outside the agency and much-needed leadership. As for his replacement,
based upon reputation and what he's done, and if you look at his resume and everything else, he's an outstanding choice.
The man Judge Robart named as the new monitor is Dr. Antonio Oftelli, a Harvard fellow with an impressive resume on police, policy, and reforms. In recent papers, he's urged calm, caution, and bridge building when it comes to calls for 50% defunding of police. And instead of slashing funding, he says three things need to be the focus: ending police brutality, protecting vulnerable people, and creating the future of public safety, which he says must include shifting priorities and funding to address social problems rather than criminalizing them. The judge also named Manisha Harrell as deputy monitor. Harrell is chair of Equal Rights Washington and a major player in police reform and accountability efforts from Seattle to Olympia and beyond, having been a main driver of I-940, the state's new police accountability law, while also currently serving on the governor's task force to reform independent investigations on deadly use of force, as well as working with legislators on dozens of police reform bills for the upcoming session. The new monitor was also a commissioner on the Commission for the Future of Policing in Ireland, the same commission former Seattle Police Chief Kathleen O'Toole was on. Bob describing O'Toole as an ideal of a progressive police chief who did more to push reforms and compliance than anyone else in the city. His best advice for Seattle?
The advice I have is to relearn as much as they can from the recent protests and decide how they have to change their training and their strategic approach to large crowds. One of the things that they're facing that they've not faced before is the degree to which there are people really bent on violence who are part of the mix. I mean, they were part of the mix in WTO and some of the other protests and things before, but not quite to this degree. And ISBD is just going to have to learn how to deal better with those.
And Hannah joins us live now. Hannah, did I hear correctly? It didn't sound like he was a big fan of Carmen Best.
You know, and he had said in the letter obtained by the Times, he said, you know, that she was warm and he didn't have anything negative to say about her as a person. But he also didn't praise her the way he did former police chief Kathleen O'Toole, as far as the reform efforts and the consent decree said. And he's been very specific throughout, really, about the need to have someone from outside the SPD be the new chief and be the chief. That's one of the reasons he was so fond of Kathleen O'Toole as well.
There seems to be that emphasis on trying to get somebody from the outside, which indicates apparently there's something embedded in the Seattle police culture which needs to be changed. And I guess that gets to the police union, which keeps coming up again and again. I'm guessing the police union would say, so what do you want us to do when people start rioting? And is there an answer to that question?
I don't think there is an answer to that question yet. It's going to be something that's going to have to be worked out with the monitoring team. Judge Robart, back at the beginning of the consent decree, because remember back then we were still dealing with, Occupy Seattle demonstrations, May Day protests that would get out of control, and there would be problems because of that. So they did come up with a crowd control policy that was the one that was in existence that the judge had okayed under the mm-hmm. consent decree, but it's not working now, primarily because of what Bob just pointed out there about the violent instigators that are consistently within these crowds.
Well, this is kicking the can down the road then, because if you're going to say, okay, the police have gone back to their old ways, they're using tear gas again, which you're not supposed to do, well, then what are you supposed to? I mean, the system for providing for free speech was you file for a protest permit and you agree on a route, and the police escort you, and everybody gets their message out. But if demonstrators don't want to play along with that, what are they supposed to do?
Well, and again, that answer is not done yet. So I think you're going to see that the crowd control is going to be something that is going to play out as we see the next, the Seattle City Council and the mayor come to terms on whatever the next budget is going to look like. That's going to be a big issue. There are also multiple lawsuits right now against Seattle over its crowd control policy. So the mayor in a statement about this monitor change said yesterday specifically that crowd control reform is their policy is going to be one of the main things that they'll be working with this monitor team. So that's not decided yet. We also have the new police, the new police contract is up. Those talks have to get underway very soon. And the union's going to have a lot to say about this. So what the end result ends up being, I couldn't say yet.
All right, it's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.